The Grade Cricketer is a Twitter stream. It's about playing cricket at the grade level.
It's a tough, mean, dirty, dirty business being a grade cricketer.
A lot of cricketers, you know, that's all they know. They've done it since they're 10 and they have a deep-seated fear of change.
But the grade cricket is all about being the most alpha version of yourself as possible at all costs and at all times.
I don't bat or bowl. I just feel a gully, count the number of dot balls in a row, sledge 15 yards. It's made me feel better about myself.
Thanks champ.
Oh, no, you called me champ.
Hello and welcome to the Grey Cricketer podcast on what is possibly the darkest day in Australian sporting history, or perhaps not, but we will get into all those messages and more in a moment's time. We just want to say we do very much appreciate you guys tuning in each week. So if you want to like, subscribe and rate the show on iTunes, that would be wonderful if you would care to do that. Also a reminder that we are emceeing gigs in Sydney and in London. We're going international. So if you want media and events, gradecricketer@gmail.com. We want to thank our producer. Thanks to Toby Shane for the ads and the music. Of course, Tea and No Sympathy is in all good bookstores right now in Australia and New Zealand. You can get it internationally as well, but it is going to be in the UK bookstores on June 7. Next week as well, we've got Damien Fleming on the show. But this week, my good friends, my dear listeners, Peter Lawler and Elise Perry. These interviews have already been recorded and they are absolutely sensational. We only got Pete for a very short amount of time because obviously he's the senior most Australian journalist in South Africa and the world is falling in. My name is Ian Higgins and I am joined solely this week by Sam Perry. Dave Edwards is unavailable to join us, unfortunately. But Sam, what did I wake up to this morning?
I don't know, he goes, all I just have rolling around my head is blackest day, dirty dogs, everyone's the worst. But, I mean, we're on different sleep cycles at the moment, he goes. We've had a lot of people online going, what's the great cricketer take? Which is very nice, isn't it? It's nice to want to be heard from. But, I've woken up in the UK this morning. So we're recording, and we should say this, we're recording Sunday evening Australia time, just as... The day four, I believe, is about to start. Will it start? Who knows?
Right.
This is coming out on Monday for you guys. So if the test has been forfeited, we're not going to be talking about it. We're just saying people are saying it might be, or Australia might declare their innings closed or something. So if we miss something else today, please forgive us. We're in like full moral panic mode, aren't we, in Australia? Mm. Like Australia has melted down. And like it was funny, he goes, because we're talking off air about like how hard it is normally when we do this podcast to think of what happened during the week in Test cricket, and like there's been so much stuff in the last week to talk about that is not even I've forgotten about already. Like earlier in the week, Cameron Bancroft said something about cricket, about who can hurt someone's feelings the most. That was like a week ago. There's this whole thing with Warner and Rabada, you know, five boundaries, a six, off stump cartwheeling, some massive bloke clapping in his face. That's forgotten. Because it's all about ball tampering and that question of Australian cricket as rank villainous cheaters. We are the bad guys, he goes. We're bad.
Yeah, mate, I don't know if we're going to get time this week to talk about the World Cup qualifiers that have been happening. Mate, I just like, you spend all week just like preparing for a show. You write up an agenda. You send it around to the lads. What's your take on this? Oh, by the way, this is the worst day in Australian sporting history. Should we just talk about that this is a 3-hour special.
Yeah.
So we will be going to this.
Yeah, definitely.
So Pez, I got your message. Yours was the first message I read this morning. I was out on the circuit last night, and I woke up to somewhere between 60 and 75 messages this morning, let alone from about 485 Twitter notifications and Facebook. And I didn't know what I was 15 when 9/11 happened, when Bush did 9/11, and this is the closest thing that I can think of as like an adult, where like the world's just caving in. People are sending messages like, I don't know why people want my opinion. Like, I don't know. I'm not an authority. I can make a joke about it on the internet, but like, you know. So you said, I hope you've had 185 beers and you're waking up to this shitstorm. And you were completely right. And I didn't know what to make of it. I was like, I was trying to get my head right. I couldn't get my coffee in quick enough.
Yeah.
And turns out that that Australia, are just dirty, dirty cheaters. Mate, I don't even know what the first question is. I don't even know if this even is a question. But, mate, help me out here.
Well, it's funny you talk about 9/11, he goes, because it definitely, we're obviously not comparing this to global atrocities and terrorism, but it has that feeling of panic about it. And it's interesting that you kind of, you know, you're sharing where you were when you found out. And like, I was in an antenatal class learning how to be a dad. My wife's deeply pregnant and I've got messages pinging in the UK. I may have gone to the bathroom once or twice to read, articles about what was going on. So I'll always remember that I was learning about, how to fix a sling for a child when I found out about this. But I guess what was interesting about it was, from my point of view, was that Australia adopted this crisis communications 101 approach to it, and that would explain why Smith went off the field for so long. But I really feel for their media manager and their communications team, without knowing the exact process there, but they must have decided that the red-handedness with which they were caught was so clear that they needed to produce a full and unequivocal admission of what had happened. Mm. And this is why I think it's interesting, because like I think that that's actually quite a... it's almost unprecedented in cricket to ever admit you were wrong. That's why, and everyone's really shocked by that. In many ways, it's really noble, but it's funny because it's turned a bit. I wonder whether the calculation to like fully admit that they'd done wrong, that they cheated, this naked admission of cheating, was done on the basis that the crime itself, when you think about it in isolation, ball tampering, yes, it's bad and it's a transgression of the rules. But also there's this grey area with it, at least in the playing community, where like we know that everyone's doing it. Now, just before everyone freaks out, it doesn't make it okay. But it is part of the culture of cricket, like the greyness and mild ball tampering. But there's two elements that are different here. One, it seems like the most fucking amateur ball tampering of all time. I'm sorry. Seriously, like it's not even sandpaper, it's makeshift sandpaper, it's yellow tape where you scrape up things from the turf to make sandpaper that doesn't even work. Like the least they could have done is start, get 6 for 13, you know, like that, at least they go out, you know, go down swinging. And the second part was the full admission of it, which I guess they had to do. And what's happened is the story's turned from one of like, well, how bad is ball tampering, to like, well, the Australian cricket captain has just said that they're premeditated cheaters. That position's untenable.
Yeah, I love this idea that they've admitted that they did something wrong. Because obviously, like, you know, if you smash, if you're given LBW and someone says, "Oh mate, that was Plummer," nah, smashed it. Or like you play, if you hit one to second slip, didn't even hit it.
Yeah,
didn't even hit it. So you have to lie constantly, and like this admission of truth from the Australian captain, like the highest power in the land, of just naked, you know, guilt is quite jarring. Maybe that's part of it. I don't know. I just love that. Just to touch on your observation, how fucking village the ball tampering was. Just the fact that it's yellow tape as well. You know, like I don't know if camo tape was available. You know, I don't know if like skin color, you know, like strapping tape, that would have been more, you know, incognito. But yellow tape just, I mean, it really like stood out on the field. And it's just like, but anytime a player puts his hand in his pocket on the field, you think, well, that's weird. Like, because no one's, you know, why do cricket pants have pockets anyway?
Mate, and that is the real question, I think. coming out of you're such an entrepreneur, mate. You see a business opportunity in this. You know, I mean, really, what will end up happening is kind of like the Olympics. You know, like we should all just play sport naked, really, shouldn't we? So no one can hide anything.
Mate, one of my takeaways is that is the reverse, the nature of reverse swing in itself. And I was listening to a former international player whose name escapes me. I can't remember who it was this morning. They were talking about, you know, we should be learning from how players, how other nations get the ball to reverse swing. No one fucking knows how you make reverse swing, because, like, the idea that, like, rocks on one side of the ball equals fucking bending it round corners is not true. That doesn't happen. And even Bancroft in the press conference said, yeah, look, we tried to alter the nature of the ball and it didn't work. It's just like, oh, we tried to cheat, but it didn't work. It's just like, just the notion of, like, even, you know, trying to ball tamper to get it to swing, like, that, it doesn't happen. No one really knows why a certain ball swings and why another one doesn't. Humidity, light conditions, some roughage on the ground, the pitch, like, there's so many factors that no one can really piece together. No one really knows a scientific equation as to why a fucking ball swings.
Well, exactly, he goes, and, like, no one will be enjoying this saga more, you know, from a Schadenfreude point of view than England. I mean, we're 10 minutes into this show, and we haven't mentioned that they got rolled for 58. Because it just, like, I mean, congratulations, England, I say. I mean, that is just fantastic areas. And, like, I mean, when are we going to learn as Australians that, like, we're brutish and we like to cheat and we think that's cool, but we really suck at it? Like, we have no subtlety at it at all. I mean, this stuff began with, like, us trying to be corrupt for the World Cup bid in 2020. We couldn't even do that correctly. We couldn't only get a vote. We can't even ball tamper properly as well. We've got England offering PhD studentships in the aerodynamics of swing bowling at Cambridge, and we've just got blokes with yellow tape picking stuff up from the pitch. Listen, we're giggling a lot, but there's going to be, it looks as though, judging from James Sutherland's press conference, and we've spoken to Peter Lawler earlier, who's on the ground, there's going to be some seriously grave consequences out of this. And, you know, we laugh because, you know, let's be honest, laughing is a coping mechanism for pain.
Of course.
It's hard not to go past the idea, he goes, that, like, while this in isolation is a bad thing and admission of preemptive, premeditated, you know, naked cheating, it's hard not to go past the idea that Australian cricket has made a rod for its own back and carries no reputational sympathy going into this anyway, because we have, you know, and I say we because I think this runs deeper culturally. I don't think this is necessarily a Smith-Lehman dynasty. I think in Australian cricket we broadly pride ourselves on that idea of having this kind of hard edge, playing at the edge of the laws. I'm not going to talk about that word that keeps getting brought up that we headbutt. And it really stinks. And people have been telling us for decades, for a really long time, that, like, it is ugly. And we've kind of prided ourselves on that ugliness. And there's no doubt that, like, that those attitudes fester into the decisions that you make and the ethics and morals with which you play the game. And, you know, I'm a cuck now because I've said ethics and morals. But, like, it doesn't surprise me that it tips over to something like this. And then it doubly doesn't surprise me that because of all that, it ends up as the second lead news story on fucking BBC over here. You know, because it's like the ugly, dirty, cheating Australians are at it again. And, the question is, here goes, is this the final straw? Like, what the hell happens out of this? Do you honestly think things will change?
I think this has, like, just gone so big. And I, to sort of, again, touch on another point that you made earlier, I think that when Bancroft and Smith pleaded guilty in front of the cameras during the press conference, I don't think even then that they really appreciated how big this was going to get. I don't think they appreciated until, like, the story was written as they were saying these words, that this admission of just naked cheating. Yes, we deliberately cheated. Mm-hmm. We had a meeting and we decided, yes, let us cheat now. Because that's how they spoke. That's how they talk in the Australian dressing room. Let us cheat now.
Let us cheat now. But
I don't think they really knew how big this was going to get. So, I was reading some comments on social media, the most tepid place that you can go. And people are seriously angry. I don't think I've seen a reaction to the Australian cricket team as much as such a visceral reaction. People are seriously upset. People are using, you know, perhaps over the top words like shocked, appalled, disappointed, which may all well be true, but maybe using the caveat of but isn't fair there, but I sort of wonder, in terms of, like, everything starts from the top, right? And this whole reaction of how Australia goes about their cricket, I believe, starts with Darren Lehman. So Darren Lehman has been a really successful coach for Australia. And it doesn't seem to me that Steve Smith and Darren Lehman, their personalities don't match, for instance. But I think everything does start from the top, and these attitudes do filter down. I'm not sure who's in this leadership group that would have been in the meeting, but I presume Warner would have been as vice captain. You know, Ozzie Davey's got his own issues going on. But just the amount of pressure that these guys would have been under to make this decision, like, I mean, how stressed they would have been to make this decision on day three of a test match. They're behind by 250, 300 runs or whatever it is in the third innings of the game. They're like, yeah, this is what we're going to have to do now. I can't even comprehend it, mate.
It's funny, isn't it? He goes, because when they sat down and they made their admission, it's almost as though Australian cricket was finally confessing to being bastards. Like, in fact, it was like an admission for all of us in so many ways, and I feel like it's been interpreted that way, and we're going to lose sight of the incident, and I'm not sure. I mean, maybe this is the incident we needed to have. I don't know. We're 24 that. Hours into this. I mean, this is a crisis situation, so everyone's just going to put everything out there. But, like, I struggle. I'm actually flipping a little bit because, like, you talk about the tepid, you know, sewer of social media and the commentary that's coming out. You know, I do cringe going, like, scrolling down a little bit and seeing some sort of media honchos, probably, you know, vulture-ish for clicks and whatever, in capitals saying, darkest day, I'm shocked, I'm appalled, Australian captain confesses to cheating. Like, Australia definitely has, like, an ultra-cop element to it, you know, like, where we get on our moral grandstand massively quickly about things. And then there's the other side where it's like, well, everybody's ball tampering. So really, like, okay, let's just take a second and breathe and realize that, like, in probably pro dressing rooms around the world, people are probably giggling, going, idiots, they got done, you know, but we're all doing it. And so, like, this is Australia being punished for the reputation that they've carried into all of this. It actually is all bundled up in the same stuff. And, you know, it's so easy to, like, sit on the high ground now and go, this is why it's important to be a good citizen in cricket, you know? But I will. Fuck it. I'll throw stones too.
Well, obviously, like, one of the things that's been spoken about, mate, is the, you know, the South African captain, Faf du Plessis, is, you know, literally 18 months ago, he was charged with an offence of, he had some lollies in his mouth and he put the lolly saliva onto the ball and then it made it swing like that. And then, you know, obviously there's, like, other cricketers as storied as friend of the show, Mike Atherton, who famously just put some dirt on the ball. This actually just goes to my point. The two aspects there, one bloke's putting, like, some lolly saliva on the ball, another bloke's putting dirt on it to make it swing. No one fucking knows how the ball swings. No one gets
it. Exactly.
So Scothic was labelled the lolly man. You know, a friend of the show, Vish, came on a couple of weeks ago. He was talking about another English cricketer, which can't be named, who grew an extra long pinky fingernail so he could scratch the ball.
He grew a claw.
He grew a claw to scratch the ball. So, like, these are all vastly different ways. But just the element, mate, I've just got these pictures of, you know, Darren Lehman being seen on the walkie-talkie to Pete Hanscom. It's like it was being directed by fucking Spielberg, you know? Like, it's just like the cut scenes from one scene to another. Like, it was beautiful. Like, the cinematography was fantastic, I've got to say. But just the village nature of, like, Lehman even being seen to be on the walkie-talkie, like, I don't think these guys knew how bad this was going to get until, you know, the story's been written. Do you know what I mean? Because you saw Hanscom get the walkie-talkie and he laughs. He laughs when he gets the message. Oh, bangers. Yeah. Bangers has done it again.
Again, bangers. You got caught, mate. That's a fine. It's going to be a fucking fine.
Mate, do you know what I mean? I don't think they really thought this was as bad as, you know, what it's turning out to be.
Yeah, you're definitely right about that. He goes, look, this is going to be a situation where the conspiracy is worse than the crime itself, isn't it? You know, the idea of standing together with a leadership group, an unnamed leadership group, deciding who are the famous five, that's what it's going to be, deciding to cheat. I think that image and that idea is worse probably than the thing that he actually did himself. You know, that it actually didn't even alter the state of the game specifically, but the conspiracy to do it, I think, is the worst part. And we'll see what happens.
Mate, isn't the notion that, like, you know, Bancroft was picked you know, sort of in the side. Well, he was held in very high esteem in the side because he's one of the lads. And I lean into the microphone and say it like that. But now he's just because he's a victim of his own laddishness, where he's just like, he was just like, apparently he was just around this leadership meeting, just fucking mingling about. And he's like, I'll do it. Let me do it.
Yeah.
Like Renshaw would never do it, and that's why he wasn't picked.
mate. That's exactly right.
It just wants to be one of the boys. Right. I mean, like one of the memes that's been circling around the internet, particularly from UK sources, and you know what? Probably rightly so. I saw the Barmy Army Twitter page tweet this, and it was quite funny. But there was a picture of Steve Smith and Bancroft. You might have seen this, Pez, sitting next to each other during what's known as the Bairstow headbutt interview, where they're basically laughing at each other, and Bairstow's just offering the fuck out of. Bancroft just offering Bairstow, just like regaling them with this story. Fast forward 4 months later, and there's the two people just like sitting there in exactly the same seats, you know, in a different country, just confessing to cheating. And it's just like how much, you know, 4 months is a long time in cricket, et cetera, et cetera.
Life comes at you fast. Yeah, I mean, we're going to talk to Peter Lawler in a second about this. And I suppose the last thing I was going to say about it, you were mentioning earlier that. You know, Lehman's on the walkie-talkie to Bancroft, who's laughing. It's probably a nervous laugh, to be fair. Sorry, to Hanscom, I should say. It's probably a nervous laugh and one to kind of shake it off. But because when you looked at, you know, Lehman's face, it was pretty crimson with fear, I think, when he realises he's on camera. It does go to show, though, that, like, ball tampering kind of occupies, in cricket circles, this, like... you sort of get cred for knowing how to regale in the dark arts of cricket. And like, it's so cricket to like spend your life caring about the impact of dirt on a ball to make it move like a centimeter. Like, it's the lamest, least cool thing of all time. But like every team's kind of got someone who like nerds it up, but also gets, it's like a, like the kid who mucks up in class, like just trying to, you know, being able to get one over the teacher. There's always a, like, it's a social dynamic thing. And it's really blown up in their faces. Like, I mean, surely you've played in teams, he goes, where, like, there's always one or two people who are super keen to tell you how they can make a ball move in ways that aren't, you know, scientifically possible if you just apply this one weird trick.
Every bit of clickbait, yep.
Yeah.
Get six-pack abs and make it fucking go around corners. Yeah. Mate, also just, I just love the childishness of like, of Bancroft like putting the yellow tape down the front of his pants, and like it's now being shown in super slow motion in crystal clear HD. You know, like I used to think that one of the best things that like crystal clear super slow mo HD, that one of the best things you could see is like Tiger Woods out of the sand and like the sand just like spilling out over the bumper, the revolutions of the tidalists going backwards and backwards as the ball spills toward the green. But now it's this yellow tape being put down the bloke's dick.
Yeah, that's right. That'll do more numbers than Tiger ever did.
Pez, I don't know if you've got any more to say. Do you have any more to say on the topic or through my?
I'm just looking at my notes here. I've also got G. Cummins Boldwell.
Oh, the old forgotten test match. All right. I did say before we were very fortunate to get Peter Lawler, the most senior Australian cricket reporter who's in South Africa at the moment. We got him in an Uber and we'll just hear from him in just a moment's time. Before we get to our very, very special guest, Elise Perry, which is an absolutely cracking interview, and stick around for that. I just want to say what a show this week. It's just amazing.
I know.
There's some hashtag Ask TGCs coming on, and there's going to be more on that later. But I did get a very special message coming this week from friend of the show, Deirdre Murphy. And Pez, she writes in and she says, "Hi there, hope you're keeping well. I'm an Irish girl who knows nothing about cricket and frankly have no desire to improve my knowledge on the subject. However, my boyfriend Peter, a Londoner through and through, is, without exaggeration, obsessed with cricket and your show. He refuses to use his headphones when listening, as he is convinced I'll be converted to the cause if I hear enough cricket-related banter. He also insisted that I read a chapter of your latest book. To be fair, I did find some bits kind of funny. He's even started to adapt some new catchphrases, such as alpha, assuming I'll know what he's talking about. Anyway, I understand that in order to get some airtime on your show, I must ask a question. So mine is as follows. Could you please wish Peter Williams a very happy 30th birthday? I think it will make his day. All the best, D. Pete, unfortunately, we can't do that. Because that's not part of our contract, so I apologise. But thanks so much for writing in, D. That's that was very kind of you. It was a good try. Good try to get us to do that. But, yeah. Pez, anything?
No, I mean, don't they tell you in improv just to always say yes to the person before? I mean, I probably would have said happy birthday, but I'm just going to go with your approach to this. Pete's been such a... He actually has been a really great fan of the show, I think, so... Did you ask for us to have beers, Pete, at some point, or am I just trying to still find friends here in London? I'm not sure.
All right, Peter Lawler coming up.
Are you upset that no one comes to watch you play cricket? Are you tired of no one appreciating you for the talented third grader you are? The Cricket Family is the first program dedicated to helping people like you feel relevant again. We have a database of over 1,000 out-of-work actors who can come to your games and masquerade as your friend, girlfriend, wife, parents, or grandparents, helping you create the perception that the people close to you actually care about what you do.
Ah, great shot, Jason.
No, I'm proud of you, son.
The Cricket Family, helping cricketers feel relevant once again.
It's a complete privilege for the great cricketer to introduce this next guy. I'm sure there's an official title there, but everything is happening so quickly. He's over in Cape Town at the moment. I've just woken up to a feeling of there being some sort of almost terror attack. He's the senior most journalist in Australian cricket. Let's just put it that way. If not the world, I'm talking about Peter Lawler. Pete, welcome to the great cricketer.
thank you. I'd say it's a pleasure to be on, guys, but under these circumstances... It's nothing much of a pleasure, is it?
Well, I mean, tell us, Pete, you've been around the traps for a very long time. What? It's only been 24 hours since this stuff's emerged. What's the feeling in Cape Town? Where's this going to rank? How dark is this day?
Yeah, well, look, I'm in an Uber on the way to the ground. I've had some time to process it last night, and it took time to process, didn't it? Because the enormity and the gravity of it just wasn't apparent. At first blush, you knew something big had happened, but, you say terror attack, it's just gone nuclear. It feels like one of those sort of black swan moments in cricket, doesn't it? I'm stunned. Not many things are going to be the same after this. I can't see Stephen Smith surviving as the captain of the Australian cricket team. I can't see a few others surviving as well, but it's bigger than that even, isn't it? Because it's about the game and the way Australians play the game. Those guys who invested with faith from the public, they are the Australian cricket team. It's always seemed like a hokey idea, but nothing more apparent now that they've let everybody down. And look, there's a bubbling feeling among senior players, and among the great cricket community of Australia. That these guys are on their own on it, that they've brought shame on everybody who plays cricket in Australia, and I'm talking about Shield cricketers and BBL cricketers and Park cricketers and kids, and nobody's happy. They're on their own, I reckon.
Pete, just in terms of like the stuff you said about nothing being the same, it almost sounds like, I mean, not the straw that broke the camel's back. This is more like an axe which hacked the camel's back open. But do you think everything that's come before it in this test series especially has led to this moment being so massive? Like, this is the last straw sort of thing.
Yeah, good point, Ian. It didn't happen out of the blue. That's why I say it's bigger than the players who've committed the act. You've got to ask serious questions about the culture of the team. To go even further back than the events of this series. But, yeah, they placed enormous pressure on themselves by setting up, like going in for the kill on this series, doing that sort of ugly Australian attack thing that they do, and it's backfired on them. They were looking stupid before this happened. They were looking stressed, clearly very stressed to come up with a plan like that in the dressing room. But you got to say, how does a dressing room culture get you to a place that's seeing your players on day three of a test match sit in a lunch room and think it's a good idea to do that? Something rotten at the heart of Australian cricket there.
Peter, I realise you're...
Australian cricket team.
Sorry to interrupt, Pete. You're in an Uber, you're getting to the ground, you've probably got to go in a sec. Just to probe the actual incident itself and getting your view on it, I mean, I reckon there's a bit of a disconnect, this is my view, like a bit of a disconnect between the pro-playing community and the wider community on attitudes to ball tampering, you know? I mean, for the pro community, it's this sort of mischievous dark art where it's a bit ethically blurry. Many would say that mild tampering happens in every game, and I don't mean to say therefore it makes this okay. The wider community has just seen... an admission of, you know, premeditated cheating. Is there any... do you think we're going to go into this a question of, like, how Cameron Bancroft actually came up or how they came up with this method itself? Because it looked really amateur.
Yeah, look, I think he's collateral damage in a way. I don't think he matters too much. I mean, he's not a coin skin. He deserves punishment. He deserves to miss the next test match for what he did. I'm interested in what you say about a disconnect between the public and cricketers on this cheating, because every single former player or that I have spoken to is just outraged. This is just totally unacceptable. You do this, you're a cheat. They have more sympathy toward lollies and, you know, sugar in pockets and those sorts of processes. They even have more sympathy towards a thumb. It's funny, isn't it? I'm not going to use that phrase, but they keep talking, that thing that they cross.
Yeah.
Even a thumbnail has a sense of being a little bit more organic, shall we say.
Yeah.
But to instigate something from, you know, outside and take it onto the field, yeah. I think most people are sort of standing shoulder to shoulder.
Yeah, okay. So, yes, that was the voice of Peter Lawler. He clearly has just dropped out in an Uber. He probably has far more important things to do, like speculate over whether this test match will be forfeited. You'll find out by the time you're hearing this whether that actually happened. We're really lucky to get him anyway, because he's right at the scene, literally at the scene of the crime. Well, he goes, it's that time of the week again where we, you know, pay homage to our commercial partner, Budgie Smuggler. Budgie Smuggler. I learned this week, he goes, that... their sales have gone up due to these ads. I was told by the man at the top their sales have gone up, and he literally called them beta sales. Beta male sales have gone up. Because this is a strategy of Budgie Smuggler to appeal to beta males. It's very much got alpha males covered, the peacocking covered, but for all you beta males listening out there, and that includes me as well, I'm not so sure about you, Higos. Your rig's looking very good these days. Budgie Smuggler is welcoming you into the fold. Yeah. And you can go to budgiesmuggler.com.au to actually get their smugglers. You can get them customised. No doubt some sandpaper smuggler orders will be coming in at some point. No, actually, there needs a bit of time there, doesn't there, Higos? Because comedy is tragedy plus time.
Yes,
so
I've always said
a little bit of time
that,
before the... the sandpaper orders come in. But, Budgie Smuggler. Look, we don't partner with behemoths, really. These guys come out of a backyard in Australia. They're making it big in the UK as well. So if you want custom Budgie Smugglers, like a lot of teams do, I probably wouldn't shower with them. That's bad social capital. Go to budgiesmuggler.com. Here you go.
Mate, it's really interesting because I've just been thinking about this whole ball tampering situation, and I don't want to bring our good friend of the show, Budgie Smuggler, down to the level. I don't want to associate them in any way with, you know, the darkest day in Australian sporting history, but I will say that, you know, it's fair to say that Cameron Bancroft did slide that yellow tape into his budgies, and, you know, evidence was hidden. Evidence was hidden, and if you want to hide evidence, if you've got a body to hide, Budgie Smuggler, budgiesmuggler.com.
I like that we don't even know if it's .com.au or .com. Yeah. Just try both, listener. Seriously, you'll get it.
This summer, we've got the biggest renovation challenge yet. Two teams will have to transform not one, but two broken down grade cricket dressing rooms every single week. There will be tension.
What even is grade cricket, Dazza? Why did we take time off work to do this?
Come on, Charlesy. Work hard, love.
There will be drama.
I just want to make this perfect. Great Cricket deserves a great home.
But when the reveal comes, there will be joy.
Oh God, lads, boys, look at this, right? Results!
Ever since the missus booted me out and took the kids, I've been sleeping in this dressing room. It's a second home to me, literally. So this is really special.
For us to be able to come in and give these grade cricketers a beautiful new dressing room, one they can drink their beers in, sing the club song, judge each other in the showers, yeah, you know, it makes you feel good.
But this ain't no charity. Not when the stakes are this high.
I'm not here for a bloody holiday. If I wanted that, I would have gone to Bali or Thailand.
It's Australia's toughest renovation competition. Winner takes all.
If I have to dish out a little bit of chin music, I will.
Presented by Australia's favourite knockabout blue-collar larrikin millionaire.
We're giving great cricket the reno makeover it deserves.
Reno Rampage. Coming soon.
Here goes. This is a very special interview, and can I just start by saying I don't think I've been more nervous for it, because the person we're about to talk to is probably the highest achiever I seem to have ever come across in my life.
Yeah, maybe.
We were both talking about this. You know, my voice is shaking thinking about it, but we have secured their presence somehow. So let's, you know, try not to stuff it up. We always start with the numbers. Here goes.
Always.
So let's go with some numbers here. I'm going to read them out. Seven tests, an average of 61.71, second decimal place. Highest score of 213 not out. 97 ODIs, average of 51.83. Highest score of 95 not out. Best of 6 for 32 with the ball in tests. 5 for 19 in ODIs. 4 for 12 in T20s. A top-ranked ODI bat in the world, youngest to play for Australia, won a World Cup. In December 2017, won the inaugural ICC Women's Cricketer of the Year Award. On a personal level, though, let me just say this as a complete opposite. You know, her elevation to stardom and deeply significant place in the pantheon of Australian sport has come at a great personal cost to me, because now whenever I Google Sam Perry cricket, I'm faced with 10 pages of cricketing tribute to another Perry. Other than playing for the same club, and that according to Wiki, we were both born in Wurrunga, she bears no relation to me at all, so I can't even claim family status. I'm of course talking about Elise Perry, who joins us from the Taj in Mumbai. Hello, Pez. Welcome to the Great Cricketer.
Well, hello, Pez. Thanks very much for having me on. I'm really excited to be chatting to you guys.
Oh, that's good. Look how you sound so media trained, Elise. All right, let's get into this. Elise, you're probably the most successful dual international in Australian sporting history. They're my words. So let's then start at the obvious place, Sydney grade cricket. Mm-hmm. What does grade cricket mean to you?
A heck of a lot, actually. And to be honest, it probably all starts back when I first learnt to play cricket, and it was all because my dad was a Sydney grade cricketer for many years,
right.
First at Cumberland, and then he played for Sydney Uni. So I I endured many hours of grade cricket stories that my dad thrust upon myself and my older brother. And I think ever since then, that's all I can kind of remember about starting out with cricket. But certainly got to also play some grade cricket along the line as well, which has been great.
Yeah, so let's go there, Pez. I mean, we'll, so 2010, you played against Blacktown, PGs, Blacktown, 2020 game, 4 overs, 2 for 14. You also scored 5 not out, memorably, of course, and the team won by, you guys were chasing and you won with 17 balls to score. It's all just stats to show, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, like, every stat is amazing.
What do you remember about that day in particular? There's a Courier Mail article going around which I read today, and it was sort of, they said that the pavilion there at Drummoyne Oval when you played that game was renamed Elise Perry Pavilion. I mean, this is your first game of sort of men's cricket. What are your memories of that day?
Oh man, that was so much fun, that game. I'd sort of grew up playing all my cricket with the with the guys in junior club cricket, and then when that finished up, I think I'd under 16s, I'd sort of went into playing a lot more women's cricket just because of the pathway opportunities to going and playing at a higher level. But yeah, it was really cool to go back and play some the PGs game. A couple of guys that I actually grew up playing cricket with, the Oak Hill College Cricket Club, then in that team, the Sydney Cricket Club. So that was really cool. But all I remember is the awkwardness around the change room situation. So that was an interesting one. There was a lot of guys kind of tiptoeing around me, and I kind of just hid in the corner. But yeah, it was great fun, and they're a really great group of guys. And yeah, it was sort of really nice to to have that challenge. I was really nervous for it, having not played men's cricket for a long time, and then kind of been put in that situation. But it was great fun, and it was cool that we won in the end, I suppose, too.
Elise, you you mentioned the Sydney Cricket Club, formerly known as Balmain as well. I mean, we talk often on the show about players who just completely grow out of grade cricket. I'm not just talking emotionally and mentally. I just like they just get way too good for it, and they reside rather in international or professional cricket. I mean, someone like you, that applies intensely to somebody like you. Do you ever get back, to Balmain or the Sydney Tigers? I mean, do you still stay around? Can you tell us about your relationship to the club?
There's actually a few of us in the call Sydney Cricket Club our home club too, and I think probably a little bit uniquely from international men's cricket, there's a couple of gaps in our schedule every year where you can actually fit in a game or two of grade cricket. I've been reminded constantly by Elisa Healy, who also plays at Sydney Cricket Club, that I haven't turned out this year. Turned out, I accidentally forgot my spikes. I don't know how fondly I'm actually looked upon at the moment by the Sydney Cricket Club, but it's a great breeding ground for lots of for players, and I think also probably because there's not as many grades in women's grade cricket, you've got a whole spectrum of age groups and players at different parts of their careers, whether they're sort of like young and upcoming talents or they're sort of players that have been around for a long time. So it's always a really cool experience to go back and play club cricket, but I'm in a bit of trouble because I haven't turned out for a while.
Well, let's talk about what's happening at the moment with the women's team and yourself. So you've just dusted off India in an ODI series 3-0. You're probably going to claim that wasn't revenge for the World Cup final, even though that's definitely a lie.
Yeah.
And it is. But you've also done really, I mean, you scored 70 not out, and you've taken 2 for in a couple of games and a 30, 25 not out as well. I'm just reading numbers to you again. I mean, you guys must be pretty satisfied about a 3-0 series result in India against India.
Oh, yeah, it was total revenge. no bones about it. Unfortunately, we still can't get that World Cup match back. But, it's been a really great series for us, actually. India are a really upcoming team at the moment. They've got some awesome players, world-class players that are really tough to play against. So I think to come over to India and beat them quite convincingly in their home conditions was awesome. And the team's in a really good spot, actually. We've had a great time over here. Like, everyone's contributed at different times and with runs or wickets. And I think when you're in India as well, like, there's so many cool opportunities to get away from the cricket field and go and see amazing things and kind of get amongst the culture. So we've had a great trip, and but I think certainly the sweetest part was sort of beating them 3-0 after the drubbing they gave in the World Cup. Still gives us all the best, so.
Well, I mean, the richness and the ambience and the backgrounds, it sounds like you're really getting amongst it. Are you on the street at the moment? Like,
yes,
the,
right.
The traffic is just fantastic. Yeah. It feels like I'm there with you, Elise.
I left my balcony door open just for the ambience, just to prove it.
You are like such a pro, Elise. As in, like, you know how to leave grade cricket and know that you're too good for that, leaving the door open for the ambience. Talking about being, cultured through India as well. I'm trying to probe for the dark spot here. I mean, you guys got dusted. You guys got dusted by England. I mean, that's got to hurt the other day.
We did yesterday. Feel pretty raw. Thanks for bringing me back down to earth. Yeah, we did. So we're playing a tri series of T20 matches now. So after the one day, as England have come across, and oh my gosh, they're all translucent white at the moment, which Pez, you might know about. in England at the moment, but apparently that didn't bother them, and they're all wearing long sleeve shirts and long pants and those big floppy hats because I think they're all getting burnt to a cinder, but they still played some good cricket yesterday. So fortunately we went down to them, but we've got another game against them on Monday, so hopefully we'll play a little bit better.
Well, Pez, I was just saying to the other Pez off air that I've always said that beating England in India is one of the hardest tasks in world cricket, so I wouldn't be too downtrodden. But you sort of touched on a few things there, actually, but I just want to know about, like, sledging in the female game, and excuse my naivete by asking that, but, like, how fierce does it get on the field?
I guess it has its moments. I don't know if you guys are aware, but our wicketkeeper for Australia is Aliza Healy, niece of Ian Healy. So
yes,
that seems to run very strongly in the genes of Healy. Midge, as we call it, has a real affinity for words, particularly on the cricket field and particularly aimed at the opposition. So, it's played very competitively and I probably don't think there's as much sledging as men's cricket, but there's still a bit of it, yeah.
It'd be remiss of us not to talk about I'm not going to call it the crowning moment because users have done so many incredible things. So we've been talking about numbers the whole time, but, I mean, just run us through 213 not out at North Sydney Oval against England, essentially to secure the Ashes under lights. I'm sure everyone's asked you about it. I'm not even sure what the feeling is, but I mean, where does that rank for you, I suppose, in terms of what you've achieved in sport?
It was really cool. I think the fact that I was
really
like,
cool.
I think I probably need to give most praise to the groundsman who produced an absolute slab of concrete to bat on.
It's Peter Devlin.
So that was ideal for spending a long time out in the middle. But look, certainly I think just the whole occasion, if I'm to be a little bit serious about it, was just absolutely amazing. I mean, we had awesome atmosphere every day. It was the first ever women's day night test match. It was the first ever Ashes day night test match. And we just had such a great crowd come in every day at North Sydney Oval. I mean, it's such a special oval. It's got so much history and it looks brilliant. And just to play in front of that crowd and to I think it was really significant in terms of where women's cricket sort of come to, and the support that we have around the team now was just awesome. And to spend that time out in the middle and have a chance to bat for as long as I did with a bunch of partners at different times was really cool.
So what I'm hearing is you've got command of the word translucent and you're also humble. This is the first time we've had this on the show. I mean, just on the women's cricket question, Elise, I listened to a really interesting interview the other day, and we've plugged it before, but Adam Collins and Jeff Lemon's podcast, The Final Word, interviewed Jared Waitley the other day, and they were talking about his sort of State of the Nation speech that he gave when he started at SEN. And one thing that he said within it that really struck me was that he said he doesn't understand why his daughter can't buy an Elise Perry bat at Rebel. He said that fathers all around the country would buy an Elise Perry bat, but all they can do is buy, a Warner or a Smith bat, etc. It's probably a hard one for you to answer, but any bats in the works?
Look, I'm just jotting that point down now, and I'll have a chat to Adidas as we hang up. I just think it's been amazing in the last couple of years particularly, and it's probably not just women's cricket, it'd be women's sport in general, particularly in Australia. Like, I know the AFLW Grand Final just recently played, that's been a huge success, that competition. The Matildas obviously are doing amazingly well, and they've got huge crowds turning up as well to their matches and following them around the world. And I just think it's such an exciting time for women's sport and for young girls who are growing up now. And really into their sport, that the opportunities available for them, you know, depending on what sport they want to play and where they want to go with it, are just, in so much abundance now. And that is just so exciting to see. I know, you know, every match we've played this year at in the WBBL, the amount of young girls that have turned out to those games and hang around to meet you later and just absolutely love their cricket is, it's so brilliant to see. And it really has come such a long way in a couple of years.
Just in terms of the test matches, Elise, I mean, I actually went down to North Sydney Oval because it's next to my house, basically, like twice, and I saw you score 200 that day. I just want to tell you that I was there when Elise Perrin scored 200. I'm going to tell the person that. But just like in terms of, like, I mean, you average a million in test matches, so why wouldn't you want to play more? But, like, you guys must want to have that every single time because, like, the experience of playing North Sydney Oval under lights, you know, people were flocking to the grounds all days was fantastic. Obviously, obviously just a caveat. Your 200, it was a road, so it doesn't count. But you got, you guys as a team must want to play test matches as often as possible, surely.
Before I answer that, I actually have a question for you. Did you think that ball went for six when I prematurely celebrated? Or...
I don't want to break your heart, but I saw it bounce. And then I was like, what's she celebrating for? She's miscounted. It's 198, Elise. Where are you going?
Well, I'm a math teacher, so that's no excuse either. It's singly the most embarrassing moment of my career, I think. So I'm yet to find something. I think six, but anyway. I can't even remember what your question was. Test matches.
Test matches, yeah.
That's right, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, as someone that grew up watching a lot of Test match cricket and going out to the Sydney Cricket Ground every New Year to watch the Test match and, knowing all the players as household names, I think it's still certainly the pinnacle of cricket, and we absolutely love playing them. So every opportunity I've had to wear a baggy green hat and go out on the field, certainly make the absolute most of it. And I think... obviously women's cricket's, very different to men's cricket in terms of the way it's set up and the importance of the limited overs format is so huge. But I think what would be really cool going forward is potentially playing more of the style of that we play in the Ashes series where we play all formats and actually doing against some of the other top nations in the world. So, India, New Zealand, South Africa. So that would sort of increase the amount of test matches we play. And therefore, I think, teams would get much better at them, but also, it's still making the limited overs formats relevant. So potentially in the future, that'd be really cool to see it go that way. But who knows?
Elise, let's be honest, you've not come onto this show to talk about the kind of virtues of women's cricket necessarily. You've come on for throwdowns, where we essentially probably should be talking to you about all of your achievements, but we'll just wrap up our own jokes self-indulgently within the questions. So we'll get onto the throwdowns now. Please just ignore them if you think they're terrible. I'll kick them off. Elise, when you do get back to Drummoyne Oval for grade training, on the rare occasion you do, which kit do you wear when you stand behind the bowlers with arms folded, not participating? New South Wales Breakers, Sydney Sixers, Australian cricket, or your Matildas kit from the 2011 FIFA World Cup in Germany?
Yeah, well, I definitely don't have Sydney Cricket Club kit.
That'll do. He goes.
Probably my kit that I've come from the beach in. But tell you what, the biggest nightmare, though, when you rock up to trainings like that is opening your kit and realising that you haven't brought, like, a plain helmet and you've only got your Aussie helmet with, like, the coat of...
Faux pas. And then,
worse.
You know, do I walk down in the nets with my Aussie helmet looking like an absolute drop kick, or do I risk getting hit in the face and losing three teeth? Or do anyone have any gaffer tape? I'm just going to cover up the coat of arms. Like, it's the worst.
Grim.
What I would give to have that dilemma, Elise. Yeah. All right. I mean, Elise, Sam has previously mentioned your achievements, but let me just wrap this joke up. At just 27 years of age, you've played in the Football World Cup, Cricket World Cups, won the W League with Canberra, the BBL with the Sydney Sixers, won the Belinda Clark Award twice, got engaged, won Player of the Series in an Ashes, scored an Ashes double 100 in your hometown, got married, and been associated with a number of charities and charity work. What's been your most successful Instagram photo?
certainly anyone with my dog, I think. Not many people have posted. I certainly love putting photos of my dog on my Instagram. yeah, definitely that one.
That's a winner. Yep.
Just following up that, Elise, when Meg Lanning tries to alpha you by saying how many tons have you scored, do you reply how many Soccer World Cups have you played? You don't have to answer that.
Oh, I'd love you to ask that question. I haven't said that to her.
Because you're a normal, nice person.
All right. When you're at the pub with your mates, Elise, having a couple of schooners after work on a Friday night watching live sport, is it annoying to your friends when you say, I could have turned pro at whatever selected sport you're watching? Because unlike most middle-aged men who could have made it had it not been for that bad knee or second child, you actually could have? I don't know what I expect you to say to that.
It's really hard for you, to be honest. This is not about you at all.
I feel that this segment is certainly entirely for you, but no, because I like to be invited back to the pub the following week. So,
it's nice. Look at that. Okay, Elise, you went to a school called PLC, which will mean something to a very few amount of people who listen to this podcast, and nothing to everyone else. I'm just looking at your Wikipedia page. You were sports captain, athletics captain, cricket captain, and political cartoon captain. Are you trolling your own Wikipedia page to trick interviewers like me? Because what is a political cartoon captain, and what do you do in that post?
Yeah. Some jokers put that into my Wikipedia page, and I actually would like to thank whoever it was, because the amount of times I've been asked by journalists to try and spruik it as like another achievement, and I'm like, I don't even know what that is, let alone I don't think it's an achievement. Like, if you draw John Howard's eyebrows, like, yeah, good for you, but I'm not really. I tell you what, it encapsulates how cool I was at school if you're a political cartoon captain. So.
You didn't have enough posts as it was. He goes in.
Elise, I just want to ask, so Joe Robbins was the first player to be dismissed by a woman in the 117-year history back then of Sydney Grey cricket. You had him caught by Nick McMurray, who coincidentally was actually someone that I played with as well. What did you send him off with?
A kiss.
The worst of all.
He was actually a pom, which was the best thing about it, actually. I didn't feel the slightest bit sorry for him when I heard his accent, so.
Brilliant. Elise, another thing that happened to you when you, I think you were playing for Sydney, I could be wrong, you in your footballing career, you lost 3-2 to Chelsea LFC in the 2013 International Women's Club Championship. I'm also noting that you've mentioned off-air that you're about to spend some time in the UK, and I've also noted that Manchester United have just announced their first women's team. And so I guess what I'm asking is your move to UK a come-and-get-me plea to United?
Well, if you don't mind sending this podcast straight to United, that would be much appreciated. I'm actually residing not too far from Manchester, and wouldn't mind a gig there, so happy for you to send it, but I think it might fall on deaf ears, unfortunately.
Well, Elise, what a sport you have been through all of this. And thank you very much for giving us 20-plus minutes and then allowing 10 of those minutes to be for us making jokes that you can't really answer. That's a complete waste of probably your time, and we've probably wasted our time. But seriously, though, it hasn't been a waste of time. We really appreciate you coming onto the show. Wish you all the best, more than you've already achieved, which is incredible. Good, enjoy your time in the UK as well, a well-deserved break, and thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me, guys. It's been lots of fun, and I'm certainly a couple of feet shorter now after those questions.
Someone's got to do this. It's great cricket. No, we kid because we love. Thanks very much, Elise. We'll catch you next time.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.
I don't play cricket for results. I don't come to take wickets, score runs, or win games. I play cricket to look good. Rigs, chests, pipes, circuits, salads. This is my domain. So when I hit the sheds, I need to radiate success. That's why I use Chop King Cologne by TGC. With a blend of the finest handcrafted English willow and Kookaburra Red King leather, Chop King Cologne lets me radiate cricket. Whatever the ground, whatever the circuit. Chop King Cologne. The new fragrance for men by TGC. Reek of runs without hitting them.
Those were the two voices of our good friend of the show now, Peter Lawler, and then our very good friend of the show, Elise Perry. I swear this show somehow gets bigger and bigger every week, even though people aren't really playing cricket in Australia anymore. I mean, I've said these wonderful things about our two favourite guests now, but my favourite time of the week is right now, Sam Perry, because it is hashtag AskTGC. And we've got another guest on the show, which people already know about because they've seen the description of this podcast, so they know who's coming. But tell us who our guest is for hashtag AskTGC this week.
He goes, thanks for that. I'm very much looking forward to this. I know I always say this, but this is a new direction. And this came from an idea that we discussed many, many years ago, he goes, alongside Dave as well, where we started to get a lot of questions from people on the internet. And while a lot of them on the surface are quite funny and kind of have a comedic value, there's some searing pain that sits behind a lot of it. And there's a point, you know, there's a point where you sort of go, are we really qualified to answer these or to kind of skewer people's emotions? Because we've been these people before as well. And so we thought, wouldn't it be great to see if we could invite a clinical psychologist onto the show? And the day has come. The day has come, he goes. And it's with great pleasure I introduce Dr. Tim Sharp, Chief Happiness Officer at the Happiness Institute, speaker and consultant, writer and coach, positive psychologist and mental health advocate, adjunct professor at UTS Business School and RMIT School of Health Sciences. Dr. Happy, welcome to The Great Cricketer.
Oh, thanks for having me. And you, I guess you forgot in that very, very average schoolboy cricketer as well.
Well, that was obviously the first question, Dr. Happy. I mean, we've talked to Elise Perry, we've talked to Mike Atherton, we've talked to Brendan Julian, you know, of all people. And the first question's always, you know, what's your relationship to amateur cricket?
I had a very strong love of amateur cricket. I played all the way through school, and I guess I can put myself in the same category as Athers in one respect. I opened the batting. That's probably about the end of our similarities there. But no, I loved it and then kept it up socially after school for a while, but probably not as long. I would have liked to have kept it up longer, I suppose.
Very good. Okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to run Ask TGC exactly the same way as we always do. Mm-hmm. He's going to read out the question, and we're just, you know, and then I'll have my view and you'll have yours as well, he goes. But we want to get the view of the psychologist as well. So why don't we have a first crack, he goes. Why don't you read out the first one? Let's see what Dr. Happy has to say about these cricket questions.
I can't believe this is finally happening. This has been about 2 years in the works, but it's finally happening. Anyway, all right. So Drew Medaglia gets the first crack this week on hashtag AskTGC, and he says, I'm a 45-year-old father of four career parkie who has just had their last and only chance of a triple C destroyed by my captain, no less, in the semi-final. I was 90-odd, 84, and cruising to my possibly last 100 and realistic chance of a triple C.
Okay, can I stop you, guys? So, Dr. Happy, are you aware of what a triple C is?
No, I did mean to ask that actually. Sorry.
Okay. No. A triple C is what we call a century circuit and chop. Chop being another word for sexual intercourse, which is a and I just see you just cringe as I say that on Skype here. But it is what it is. These are these concepts and phenomena that occur in cricket, and it's the idea of scoring 100 on one day on the same evening going out with your friends, and then ending the evening with fornication.
And so this is a 45-year-old father of four talking about missing out on that. So carry on. Here goes.
Yep. yeah. Where did he go? Is he gone? He's got no, he's still there.
Well, there's no camera.
he carries on. He says, I played my only on drive of the last few seasons off their left arm quick, who was destroying our side, back behind the bowler while the rest of the side was crumbling to elimination. As it was ball one of the over, a quick single would get me off strike and allow our skipper, hiding at eight, to take guard and protect me from the rest of the quick's final pumped up over. I called and took off only for mid on to dive and take the ball. I safely get to the other end and my partner is still there, ball watching. The ball is thrown to the striker's end, celebration ensues, and only gets more enthusiastic when I am ruled out as a non-striker, never left his crease. The away crowd gives it to me as my triple C flushes away before my eyes. Question: if no club fines are in place, what penalties can be handed to my skipper for destroying my triple C while at the same time not endangering his faith in a dangerous 90 kilometres an hour outswing? Also, where can I purchase Chop King?
Well, as with most Ask TGC questions, he goes, there's a lot going on, isn't there?
Yeah.
And I want to kick off with a few presumptions, really. Firstly, that he would have achieved the final C of the triple C. So I'm not sure he was quite over the line yet. I'm a bit curious about there being an away crowd at all. What level is this? Is Drew Medaglia a pseudonym for George Bailey or something? I doubt it. But I suppose what we're really talking about here is punishing teammates who get in the way of your success. Dr. Happy, do you have a view on that?
Oh, look, I'd just like to start by saying how much pain I feel for this for a poor rider in. It's a sad, sad situation. But I suppose in a slightly more serious note, one of the things we need to know in life generally is who our audience is, I suppose, and we need to know who we're working with, who we're playing with, and especially if one of those people is our captain or a boss. So I suppose my words of advice might be to know your audience and to know your strengths and the other people's strengths so you can work best with each other. Punishment tends not to work, so I'd be looking at how can you find some good in your captain, which might be hard at the moment, and maybe reward that instead.
that all sounds very sensible. My big takeaway is that like he's on 84 and he's trying to get himself off strike. And so he's just run himself out. So I mean, you know. And where can you buy Chop King? You can't, but we will take cash donations directly into our bank accounts. Stephen Watts writes in using the hashtag AskTGC, and he says, I need your assistance to work out who the alpha is in this situation that played out in a second-grade Shires qualifying final between my team, Linfield, and Epping CC. The aggressive opening batsman from Epping, who had been suspended earlier in the season, progressed to 30 as he ran the ball off the blade between second slip and gully for an easy two. Following the shot, he raised his bat to his teammates in the clubhouse, who began to cheer. As an inquisitive prick, I said, what is the go there, mate? Are you celebrating the little victories because you know you have fucking no chance of getting a 50? With a grin on his face, he replies, fuck off, champ. Being tired of the champ saga, I couldn't help myself and replied, nice recycling of the word champ. I bet you've been listening to the same podcast as every other fucking cricket tragic. Oh, try coming up with your own lines, you fucking parrot.
Oh.
In my best efforts to alpha over the use of the word champ, the Epping batter was fuming as he paced halfway down the wicket like a true pelican while we waited no less than 2 minutes for him to face up. Then, bowled. Tangled in a fit of rage, the bloke tries to put the rock in orbit and chops onto his stumps. We erupt. As we converge around the pitch, our 18-year-old off-spin bowler pipes up with a send-off in the ear of the batsman. Better luck next time, champ. The batsman then stops and fronts up to the lanky junior and gives him a good push to the chest as the umpires attempt to defuse the situation. Following this, we lose the game by 20 runs. And in the second innings, the same Epping batsman bludgeoned 66 not out to take away any hope of a reverse outright. So who won the battle of the alpha? Me, the batter, the 18-year-old bowler, or to predict your Shires banter, are we all beaters for playing Shires? Thanks, Watsy.
You were stroking your beard, Dr. Happy, as we contemplated this cacophony of male dysfunction.
Well, can I? Let's just throw straight to you here. Do you have any questions? You want any background on this? On this? On this whole Alpha saga?
I was striking my beer because I was reminiscing, because I'm sure that could have been a description of me 20 years ago or something. But I was also reflecting maybe on my a bit more maturity and wisdom that I have now, because I guess if there's one thing that I've learned, it's that real alphas don't compete. So if any of you are competing, you're not a real alpha. Real alphas just do whatever the shit they want, yeah. And that's it.
that's a tagline for the show. That's brilliant. Real alphas do whatever the shit they want, don't compete. I love it. Yeah, that's a funny thing, isn't it? I mean, he goes, I don't know about you, right? And thank you, Stephen, for the question. I appreciate you taking the time to write in the question. Do you sense he goes a little bit of pride in Stephen's initial sledging as well? Like, I think he was quite happy with the line, where is it? What is the go there, mate? Are you celebrating the little victories because you know you have fucking no chance of getting a 50? Like, it's a bit of a long line for a sledge, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's probably got too many words in it.
Yeah. Like, I doubt the validity of that was a sledge. I think he probably just grunted at him and swore. And because then his next sledge would have just... Because his next sledge was then, like, it was like three sentences talking about... Like, he mentioned our podcast, so it's always good to get a plug on the field.
Yeah, you know, right.
Maybe the batsman doesn't listen to the podcast, but maybe he will now. So, you know, a new subscriber.
Yeah.
So thanks, Watsy. Thanks for doing our heavy lifting for us. What was your question?
No, just, I mean... He was a little proud of his initial sledge, I think.
Because
we're talking about sledging a lot this week, you know. I mean, and we'll have discussed that earlier on the show. There's a lot of talk at the moment about whether sledging is okay if it's witty. I'm not sure if there really should be. I mean, do you have a view on sledging, Dr. Happy?
I do. I was talking to one of my mates about it just the other day as we watched. Just the other night, actually, is Dave Warner. Wandered up the path after getting out. Well, he hit five boundaries in a row off Rabada the other night, got clean bowled the next ball, and as he walked up the trail, I don't know if you say some guy in the audience was giving him a gobful, I think. Mm-hmm. And I was joking to him about it. And we were saying this, like, what's, you know, where does sledging, what's fun, what's not fun? Mm-hmm. Look, I think there's got to be some fun in it. I think mm-hmm. there's, you know, it would be a major pity if you could never say a word in jest or even a word that might get under the opposition skin. But I think in life, there's got to be a line somewhere, I suppose, and at the risk of being too sensible, you know, it comes up when, you know, when we think about bullying or cyberbullying. And, you know, I think we've got to be able to have a joke. We've got to be able to even have a dig at other people sometimes, I think. But there is a line where we need to remember that can, and this is both on and off the field, where it can actually be hurtful and harmful to other people.
So, Dr. Happy, I wonder, like, my thing about sledging was that I always thought that it said more about you as a person, as the sledger, than it did about the person that you were sledging. And, like, so in this reaction that Watsy, I just keep calling him Watsy because that's how he finished, what's his name, Stephen Watts, you know, he said that the batsman, you know, he responded by pushing the 18-year-old batsman, the alternate off-spinner, who told him to, better luck next time, champ. I mean, does that response, you know, a physical response, does that say a lot about, does it say a lot about anyone in that situation? The 18-year-old, you know, he's trying to, like, prove his worth within the squad, or the batsman who then reacted in a physical way by pushing him?
Oh, well, I think so. Again, at the risk of being too serious, I think what's become clear in recent times, or for a while now, is that certainly on the cricket field, physical contact is essentially out of the question. It's you know, rightly or wrongly, that's what the powers that be have decided, and I think that's not a bad idea, obviously. When I was joking with my mate just the other day, he sent me a picture of Dennis Lilly raising his bat. It was the Indian batsman raising his bat to Dennis Lilly when they go into a confrontation.
Me and Dad.
2013.
Me and Dad. Yeah.
Me and Dad. Jarvis, me and Dad. So obviously we don't want people hitting someone over the head with a cricket bat or throwing balls at each other. And look, it does say something. And I think when we look at some of the best sledges have been hilariously funny, but not that personal. Some of the best cricketers have been great sledges, but they know where to draw the line. And certainly I think physical contact is not, you know, something that any of us want to see on the cricket field.
Mm.
So, Pez, who won the battle of the alpha, or the battle to be alpha?
I think Dr. Happy did on this occasion.
Because alphas don't compete.
That's what we're learning.
All right. Tom Guy writes in, just a short one, hashtag IceTGC. What do your dads, what do your actual dads make of all the dad stuff?
Well, I don't know. I feel like it would be breaking the fourth wall, you know, to just discuss a good relationship with my own dad. It would kind of kill it.
There's no good answer here because I feel like we all have sound relationships with our father. I make dad jokes in front of my dad who laughs.
Yeah.
And then, you know, in my ideal situation, then he comes over and he hugs me and he says, I'm so proud of you, Ian. But seriously, when are you going to grow up?
It's a good question from Tom. But you know why, Tom? Because probably one of the most fun things we've done with the Grade Cricketer was we had the privilege of being invited by Gideon Haig, the world's greatest cricket writer, to be part of a feature interview that he was doing for The Australian a few years ago, which we were supremely nervous about. And that was his first question. What do your dads think of all this? So you're on the right track. We all have jobs and stuff like that. I think my dad's pretty keen to make sure that I'm actually doing some good stuff and that the Great Cricketer remains a fun thing. I think he's probably a bit bemused by it all, really, which is fair enough because I am too. By all this.
So, I mean, the obvious question to us, Dr. Happy, is what's with all the dad stuff? No, why do we feel such why do we feel so compelled to always seek the approval of our fathers?
Oh, I could give you the serious Freudian answer, but we probably don't want to go down that path. I think we definitely don't want to go down that
Sum
path.
Sum up dad relationships in a sentence. No.
I can't imagine a dad that wouldn't be proud of what you guys are doing, and I can't imagine a good dad that wouldn't laugh at his son's jokes. So, that's that father-son relationship. It is a very important one. And a good father would love his son, love what he's doing, if it's making him happy, if it's fulfilling him. And every son wants to please his father, and his parents, I guess. But it's one of the most intimate relationships we have. Hopefully for most of us, it's a positive one. I guess sadly for a lot of people, it's not. But that's a longer discussion as well.
All right. David Berkelmans writes in using the hashtag AskTGC, and I thought this was a good one this week, Pez. Let me know your thoughts. I gave up cricket about 18 years ago when I moved interstate. He's thrived ever since, happily married, three kids, great career, etc. I've seen photos popping up today on Facebook of blokes I play with back then winning a premiership. I have an empty, sad feeling in my stomach. What the hell is this feeling?
I love it. Like, he hasn't played for 18 years and everything has gone really well since then. He can rationally understand that, and yet one picture of mates lifting a premiership causes him to reflect, maybe it was a mistake. Is 18 years of amateur cricket grind at the and sacrificing relationships and other thriving areas of your life worth it, Dr. Happy, if you win a premiership?
Oh, look, mate, this is another sad, sad story. This is a classic case of FOMO or fear of missing out, and mate, possibly an example of what we technically call social comparison, comparing our real lives with other people's online lives. I'd say, mate, get over it. You've got a fucking good life. Enjoy it.
It's going well.
He's thriving and flourishing, and he's upset about a picture on Facebook of some guy slogging it out in the sun.
All right. Ed Stennett writes in for the last hashtag AskTGC of the week. And he says, I've kept this message to a DM for reasons that include but are not limited to my unreliability on the circuit, my lack of basic shower etiquette, and my crippling insecurity about my cricketing ability. I live in London working in IT, but I'm thinking of moving to Australia for a couple of years to work and to try out a new circuit. I need some advice. In the last 13 games I played for my club's first 11 last season, I averaged around 35 with the bat, 26.56, and took 23 wickets at around 15, 23.10. Obviously, these already average stats don't count as they were in England, where the standard is village. How good are the T-spreads, though? My question to you is, How do I handle this with a new group of 10 blokes I'll no doubt despise, especially as a tall bloke who seriously struggles to bowl over 100 clicks on hard decks? Do I alpha them from the off, shower with the chub on, and attempt to have 28 beers in the clubhouse? Or do I keep my head down for the first few weeks, restrict myself to no more than 3 pints, leaving each game early to feed my internet porn addiction? Any help would be great. Cheers, Steady.
But poor old Steady didn't realise that that question would be asked to a clinical psychologist. sorry, Steady. I wonder if he's actually calling himself Steady, or he's saying Steady, please, in this answer. But again, there's a lot going on there. This is about acceptance. Like, what does it mean to be accepted in a club, doesn't it? Do you drink with everybody and try and fit in? How do you fit into an Australian club as an English person, Higo? So, I mean, you've done it in reverse. What do you think are the ways you'd fit in, and is that something you necessarily want to do?
You know, it's surprisingly, Sam, because, you know, Australian and English people, you know, it's almost like we're exactly the same people. But, you know, colonizing and all that. How do you go about fitting into a new club? I mean, like, I was just like a normal person. Like, I mean, the currency is runs. Like, you know, if you succeed in a sporting field amongst, you know, people that you're playing sports with, if you're good, people will like you no matter what kind of bloke you are. You know, I think we had this a few weeks ago, where, like, is it better to be good or is it better to be rare? You know, like, the rare bloke, if he's a good player, can be accepted. Whereas, you know, if he's rare but not doing well, then, you know, what's the point of anything anymore? So, I mean, it's hard, though, for an Englishman to come out here and do well, because immediately Australians see themselves as, like, you know, the superior race, for lack of a term, because we are more alpha. So he's going to come out here and he's going to be alphaed. So I think he needs to just match it on the drink. He's going to be expected to be smashing pints. I would always shower with a chub on, regardless of...
Can you just explain that to Dr. Happy, please?
Oh, I'd be more than happy to, Sam, and thanks for making me do that on air. So the technique of chubbing up in the showers is just to get a bit of blood circulating in the right region, just to make yourself seem more superior, athletic, and masculine, all while showering in front of 10 other men.
This is real talk.
Thoughts?
This is real talk. Dr. Happy, what are your thoughts?
There's so many aspects of that question. I just want to raise my bat and let it go through the keeper. I'm not sure I want to touch any of them, especially the chubbing up in the shower bit or whatever. If I'm going to say anything to this guy, I'd say it's just own yourself, mate. Just own yourself, be who you are, and be the best you can be, because that's all any of us can do, I suppose.
Yeah.
that's true. I can't really add to that.
That's actually really sound advice. Well, Dr. Happy, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show this week for #RCGC. We must do this again. And I suppose the first question we didn't ask you is why you would do this.
Why are you here?
You mean risking my professional reputation?
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Just to have a bit of fun. What's a reputation worth if you're not going to have any fun? It's great. I've been massive fans of you guys for a while. It's great to be a part of it. And look, I hope if there was one tiny sliver of sensibleness in there that might make sense to one of your listeners, that might help in some way, well, that'd be a good thing.
That's great.
Absolutely fantastic.
Thanks, Dr. Happy. I know we were talking earlier about doing some promotion of you coming onto the show. I don't know if you're going to want to do that promotion anymore, but if you do, we'll be very grateful. And we do really appreciate your time, and I hope other people can take some stuff away. Cheers for coming on.
Thank you.
Well. I mean, we've recorded this show over 2 days. When we started this show, we had Dr. Happy on and we had Elise Perry. That was Saturday evening, Sydney time, Saturday morning. Pez time, as I like to call it, not London time. And since then, the world's been tipped upside down. We race into the studios. We took our Sundays off just to make some jokes about what's happening in Australian cricket. And I don't think it's ever going to end. Somehow we've only spoken briefly about England's getting bowled out for 58. So well done, England. It's a very good political capital that they've done. Damien Fleming is on the show next week. What a wonderful show it's been. Thank you, as ever, for tuning in. It's been an absolute blast. See you next week. My name's Ian Higgins, signing off on behalf of myself and Sam Perry. Catch you then.